The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to first-time novelist Christopher J. Yates, author of Black Chalk. Stick around. This story of six friends at Oxford University playing a bizarre game of their own design will make flying through the air in a Quidditch match seem quite simple by comparison. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you by Amazon.com, Audible.com, and 1-800-DIAL-DJs. Please stop by the website, MrMedia.com, click on our advertisers, support the show. And remember, there's more than 1,000 interviews available at MrMedia.com. We've been doing this since February 2007. Hope you'll find something you like. And thanks for listening. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience full of puzzle fanciers who have no idea what kind of trouble Black Chalk will get them into in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Black Chalk is an odd novel. For example, it took more than 60 pages just to figure out who the narrator is. And more than halfway through the story, you still won't know why it's called Black Chalk. And yet, and isn't this the sign of something good? You're going to be hard-pressed to put down the adventures of Jolyon, Chad, Amelia, Dee, Mark, and Jack. Oh, and I shouldn't leave out tallest, middle, and shortest. If you're fascinated with games and gamesmanship, Black Chalk is probably the book for you. Author Christopher J. Yates, once interested in law in his native England, but more recently the UK's representative at the World Puzzle Championships, and now a freelance writer and puzzles editor, has written a unique and twisted thriller that you'll find difficult to pull down, to put down. I don't know if you pull it down. Chris Yates, welcome to Mr. Media.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. Very entertaining reading the book. It's a very different kind of book, and I kind of have the feeling that you know these characters pretty well.
I suppose you could say that's absolutely true, yeah. I based a lot of them on my own time at Oxford, where I studied law. And it was when I wrote them, I was imagining how me and my friends would have done playing the game that you refer to, which means that lots of the characters are loosely based on my friends. There are differences and additions and other little strange twists to them, but there's certainly the core of some of them is from people I really did go to college with.
There are some very strong characters. I mean, you've done a real good job with the characterization. I think we get a pretty clear sense of who everybody is in the book. Any character more than the others represent yourself?
Yeah, that's a funny question, because I think people would often assume that Jolyon is the character closest to me. You know, he's kind of self-confident, he's charismatic, all of these things I'd like to be, but unfortunately I'm not sure I am. The character I'm probably closest to is the American, Chad, although as you can probably hear, I'm not American.
What? Sorry.
Yeah, although I do have my citizenship coming through in the next few months, so
oh, congratulations.
I'll soon be a semi-American, perhaps, or a full American, but... So yeah, certainly Chad was the character I felt closest to. His sense of the first time he attends college, he feels slightly out of place, underconfident, and he's really looking for a friend to guide him through the whole terrifying process. And he latches on to Jolyon, the charismatic character, and they become friends. And this is fairly similar to my own experience of college, where I was the first person from my family ever to go to college. So I really arrived knowing nothing and being terrified. And I try to get that across in the book. So yeah, Chad would be the closest to me, definitely.
I was going to suspect it would either be Chad or Jolyon, and I was leaning towards, without having met you, I was leaning towards Chad because I thought not a lot of people would describe themselves in the way that Jolyon is described. I mean, everyone loves him. Oh, so this is so. Yeah. If I'm describing myself as a character, everyone loves me. I'm brilliant. I'm this. And thought, yeah, it'd be kind of hard to be the guy writing the book and fess up that yeah, that's me.
Yeah, that would take some ego.
Yeah. Now, were you and your group of friends that interested in puzzles in school?
We certainly were. We used to sit around at weekends doing the crossword together. One of my best friends actually went into working in puzzles before I did. Hmm. And that was actually my route into working in puzzles. So the two of us worked at a puzzle magazine company together after having spent 3 years together in college.
But no taste for more dangerous types of puzzles and games at the time?
Well, funnily enough, the game that's played in the book is actually a game I came up with at college.
Oh, so this has some reality to it. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Myself and a friend were sitting around, maybe in the bar, maybe in one of our rooms, just kind of idly chatting about something, and somehow we came up with an idea for a game of psychological dares, where really the idea isn't to put anyone in danger, but to see how far you could be pushed psychologically and what are the things that would get to you. So, for example, he told me that if he was ever challenged to sing in public, he would just give up. He would just throw in the towel. That was his worst fear possible. Hmm. Whereas, you know, some people might be great singers. In fact, some people love to sing in public, as we've seen from shows like American Idol. They're not very good at it. So really, it was trying to find what might be your quirky, bizarre breaking point. So this is what led onto the idea of the game.
Imagine that, a bunch of college kids sitting around thinking of psychological dares to freak each other out. I can't imagine that ever happening in college. That seems so alien to me somehow.
No, a couple of beers, and you'd be surprised what people can move on to.
Now, Oxford, anything like Harvard or Yale and the secret societies and all that kind of thing?
I have a feeling it is. My knowledge of Harvard and Yale is only small, probably only mostly from movies. But I know that both places have secret societies. Mm-hmm. So at Oxford, for example, the famous secret society is called the Bullingdon Club. The current Prime Minister, David Cameron, was in the Bullingdon Club. The current Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, was also in the Bullingdon Club. Mm-hmm. It's really a club for rich boys they're famous for basically going to restaurants, ordering a ton of wine, and then at the end of the meal, they trash the restaurant. But because they're so rich, they then pay the restaurant owner for the damages. So this kind of fed quite a lot into my book, where you mentioned tallest, middle, and shortest, who are three of the characters. Possibly they could be from this kind of background. It's never quite revealed or explained, or it's left for the reader to decide. But certainly I had the idea that maybe they were the member of something like the Bullingdon Club, which I understand is similar to societies in Harvard.
I was going to say, you do describe in the book, you kind of infer that there is a similar club or society at Oxford, and certainly in the book. I wasn't sure if that was real or not. But obviously it was. It has some resemblance to reality.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, is it called the Skull and Crossbones?
Yeah.
Something at Harvard?
It's the one that Bush was a member of.
Yeah. Yeah, there are certain parallels between that and, you know, David Cameron, Prime Minister, being a member of a secret club at Oxford. And it does lead you to kind of ask, you know, what are these things for?
Yeah, I mean, what's the Okay, I'm not going to go down that path. I'm going to stick to puzzles and not politics. Now, I'm thinking that lots of people play games, crosswords and Sudoku, Monopoly, even Candy Crush online. But I have to imagine it's a bit more complicated to transfer an idea like that, even what you did in college, to a novel and then, you know, add personalities and events. And this being your first novel, I don't know if you had written other novels that hadn't been published or this was your first attempt, but it seems like a rather complicated way to write a novel.
Yes, it became exceptionally complicated. It took me a long time. I had to take lots of notes and lots of flashcards and shuffle things around. But I think because I enjoy puzzles, I set myself a puzzle when I wrote this novel. I said to myself, right, we're going to start here, and I want to go here, and I have no idea how I'm going to get there. It's going to be complicated, and you're going to have to kind of interlock various pieces together. And yes, so every day I woke up, I set myself the puzzle of how do I move forward? How do I get to the point I want to go to? And there are a couple of, I guess you could call them tricks being played throughout the novel. So I had to set those up, and yeah, every day was a fun challenge.
Well, just like a puzzle, I found it very frustrating until I hit about page 60, 62 and found out who the narrator of part of it was. And the other part of the structure is is a bit maddening too. There aren't chapters per se. It's little chapters that, you know, might be a paragraph or three paragraphs or two pages, and it's maddening. Which I guess is part of any good puzzle. It's just you drive the puzzle doer, the puzzler, crazy until they reach the conclusion.
Yeah, I wrote it in sometimes very small snippets, and they're headed by Roman numerals.
Yeah.
And the reference there was, if you look at the rules of a game, for example, often the rules of a game, especially if the rules were written hundreds of years ago, will be written in Roman numerals. And the other thing is the main character is studying law, and if you look at statutes, they'll frequently use Roman numerals. Especially when I was studying Roman law, I remember... I was probably influenced by games and lore to write these Roman numeral chapters. Hmm.
Of course, you do know that here in the States, the NFL has given up on Roman numerals for the next Super Bowl. They said 50 was just too confusing for Americans, so we're just going to go with a 5 and a 0. So I don't know how that Roman numeral thing is going to work.
It's going to date pretty quickly, I guess.
Maybe so. Yeah. By the way, I want to interrupt our regularly scheduled interview to point out that I am not torturing any dogs in the background here, and you are not torturing any children in the background. My dog is locked up. You have a school next to you, I believe.
Yes, and the children are out playing lovably right now.
Yes, they're happy squeals. There's no torture going on in the background. I that I know of, folks. We're 1,000 miles apart.
I think occasionally they torture each other, but
yeah, no.
And mostly squirrels joy.
No adults in the Yates house involved.
No.
Okay. Did you have any trouble convincing a publisher to buy into this book, this puzzle book of sense?
It was a little tough. I have an American agent, and she tried to sell this novel in the States to begin with. Which made sense because although it's set half in Oxford, it's also set half in the East Village in New York. But she had some trouble selling it here. And then I did a large edit to it, which I think improved it a great deal, made it more sellable. But by that point, we really needed to move on to the UK. And actually, when it went out in the United Kingdom, the very first round of publishers it was sent out to, it got picked up immediately. So I don't know if – I have no idea if that's a difference between the American and the British market or whether it was just that my edit on it was good enough. But yeah, there were certainly a number of rejections, which they call passes, in the States.
Right. Had you tried to write a different novel before this, or is this the first attempt?
No, this was my... depends how you add up the fragments. I'd completed two novels before this one. And with each one, I got good feedback from publishers. Mainly what I was interested in was them saying, this person can really write. That was the thing I was most worried about. You know, like those going back to American Idol, you get those people who stand before the judges and they can't hit a note. And when they're told they can't sing, they're bemused and flummoxed, and because they just don't realize it. So I felt that was my American Idol moment. I'd passed the audition, you know, and now I was going to be able to write the book I really wanted to write. And that's when Black Chalk arrived.
Of course, part of the problem for on American Idol is all the parents telling their kids, oh, you're a wonderful singer, you're the best, you can do no wrong, you're this. And then they go out in public and they find out, oh my God, you sound like a screeching owl.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, my parents never thought I was a great writer. So I didn't have that problem.
Oh, good. Now, tell me, I'm kind of interested career-wise, just jumping a little bit, but I know a little bit about you, not too much in detail. So you studied law at Oxford. Did you go forward as an attorney, or did you kind of give that up before it got started?
Yes, studied law at Oxford. We have a slightly different system where you can study law as an undergraduate. I then only had to do 1 year to study to become a barrister, which I did, and passed everything and began to interview for something called pupillage, which is the final stage. You do 2 more years where you train under a barrister. A barrister is basically a courtroom attorney. So I was at the stage of doing my pupillage and interviewing when I just realized I do not want to do this. So there'd been a brief interlude where I'd worked for a puzzle company, and when I hit the wall with law and decided this terrifies me and doesn't interest me either, I went back to doing puzzles and carried on doing that for several years before finally saying to myself, look, I enjoy puzzles, but I don't have to do them in an office. I can do them from home and make some money and write at the same time. So just before I hit 30, or maybe just after I hit 30, that's what I did. I threw in my job, became a freelance puzzle writer, and a kind of full-time novel writer.
Well, I've had a lot of first-time novelists, a lot of novelists on the show, but I've only had two crossword puzzle writers. You and a fellow named Ben Tosick.
Oh, okay.
He was on a few months ago. He was with the Onion AV Club, and he just did a book of the history of the crossword puzzle. Something. I'm probably getting the title wrong. Anyway, it's like 100 classic crossword puzzles and a little history. Anyway, so interesting. So we'll see who number three is.
Yeah.
So you can make a living as a freelance puzzle writer and editor.
Yeah, you certainly can, because there's not many people who know how to make up a crossword. Or maybe they could make up a crossword, but it might take them several days. You know, there are kind of tricks of the trade that you learn. And just practice. You need to be able to knock a crossword puzzle out in, you know, between an hour and a day to make it financially viable.
Do you find that your legal training has been helpful at all, either in terms of a way of thinking or the exposure that maybe you had to different ideas, perhaps?
I think it definitely has helped. When I first arrived at college, my law professor, who was a brilliant man, said, for the first for the first year, we're just going to train you to thinkers. And that's all he tried to do. And I think that that method of thinking enabled me to write quite a complex plot, because to write a complex plot, I think you have to be very logical and stringent with yourself, and you have to set down rules, in effect. So I know that in writing this book, I set myself certain rules. And, you know, being creative within the bounds of those rules is a powerful device. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think of the poem, for example, it's a structure that's designed to constrict you. Yet within that structure, you get to be incredibly creative. And sometimes these structures can actually help you.
Well, I know a lot of the guests I've had on who were lawyers first in their lives, or even private detectives for that matter, they've been trained in thinking things out in terms of this happens and then this happens and this happens. Oh, but if this happens and you get sent down this path, you need to do this to come back. So anyway, it's a way of thinking that seems very helpful to writing a thriller, an adventure novel, just, you know, things like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And is there a difference, a different level of interest from a British audience to an American audience for puzzles or that type of thing? Is it more of a puzzle's more likely to be to appeal to a British audience than an American audience?
I think probably the interest level is similar. The puzzles themselves are different. Mm-hmm. So in Britain, we have things called cryptic crosswords. I don't know if you know what they are. They're basically, a cryptic crossword is a word riddle, mm-hmm. in effect. So, you know, a cryptic crossword puzzle uses lots of anagrams and homonyms and things like this to try and lead you to an answer. So perhaps the clues are more puzzling. And it was cryptic crosswords that I really enjoyed solving. Mm-hmm. So cryptic crosswords, I think, are about playing with language, which is really what novels are as well.
I know the difference between my wife and I. My wife's an editor. We were in London last summer for a couple weeks, and it was very interesting because she loved seeing all the puzzles in the newspapers, and we would consume three or four papers a day between us because we're big news people. And so she loved all the cryptic type of puzzles and the different types of wordplay. And I look at that and I just turn the page. Where's the sports section? Where's the football scores? What's happening here? I always thought, you know, she'd probably be very good at law because of that. I've always suspected that she had the kind of mind
puzzles,
to do that.
You know, puzzles appeal to some people and not others, and it probably is to do with how our brains are fashioned.
That's a very kind way of saying, Bob, you're not as bright as the rest of us.
your wife really has the measure over you.
She does. She has the gift.
As does mine, of course.
Yes.
As do all wives.
Yeah, well, we have to say that, don't we? So, in the book, we have these young people who start as strangers, they become friends, there's some romance involved, and then they go on this path to these psychological dares. I'll go with your term there. Can you give a couple examples of some of the things that they dare each other to do in the path along the way to the game?
Yeah, certainly. So they begin as very gentle dares. One of the characters has to sit on the street with a silver soup tureen, with a sign that basically is asking for people to give him beer money. And he's dressed up in his gown and his mortarboard, which is what we're required to wear on certain occasions at Oxford. So the idea was that he looks like a rich student asking people to feed his beer habit. which passers-by do not react well to. But that's one of the very early ones. Then when they get more complicated, when the friends get to know each other better, they start to zero in on each other's weaknesses. So they know that Chad is an underconfident person. So one of the things they challenge him to do is give a speech in the Great Hall, which is a very grand setting in an Oxford college. He has to give a speech in the Grand Hall in front of an entire audience. And just to make it a little harder for him, they insist he drinks the best part of a bottle of whiskey before he does this. So they kind of build more and more from that point on.
Yeah, that one. So
one of the later ones is one of the female characters, Amelia, is the daughter of a miner. There was a big problem in the 80s with Margaret Thatcher fighting the miners. So she is asked to give a speech lauding Margaret Thatcher, which would mean she has to betray her father. And I'll leave it at that, because what happens next is for the reader to find out.
It's a big turning point in the book.
Yeah.
So what's next? Another what is there any likelihood that you will follow any of these characters again? Will you do something different?
I'm doing something different right now. I've certainly had people tweet at me asking me to write a sequel. Mm-hmm. My feeling is that I won't write a sequel, although I wouldn't say never. The way the novel ends, I really leave a lot of things up to the reader to decide for themselves, such as, you know, who has written this book, why they've written it, who tallest, middle, and shortest are. My feeling is if I wrote a sequel, I would be telling the reader the answer to a question I want them to decide for themselves. So right now I'm working on a novel. I'm about 70,000 words in, which is maybe 70%. Slightly scary because I'm writing it entirely in American, so to speak. And again, as you can tell, not American. But I tried setting my next novel in Britain and it just didn't work for me. The story didn't work in Britain. The characters didn't work. The setting didn't work. So apart from one minor character who is in there for about 5 pages, every single character is American. The narrator is American. Well, there are 3 narrators and they're all American, which is slightly worrying because there are basics about America that I perhaps don't understand as much as other people. Lots of it's set in school, in middle school. So I've managed to find a very kind middle school teacher who will help me understand the differences between American schools and British schools. So I was terrified when I started doing it, but I think I'm getting there, and the Americans who've read it so far say that you can't tell it's not written by an American.
Oh, that's either a very good thing or a very bad thing.
Yeah.
we'll have to wait and see how it sells to decide which it is.
Definitely.
Now, I have to ask you a question before I let you go. Over your shoulder, over your right shoulder, is a picture on the wall. Is that puzzle-based, or is that just – it seems like there's something hiding kind of in the –
You know what? It kind of – I guess it could be described as a puzzle. I don't think the artist – was aiming for that. It's actually by a really good artist called Paul Maynes, who's a really good friend of mine. He's very interested in circles. He paints lots of bowls, like stacks and stacks and stacks of bowls. This is another one of his circle paintings. It's actually, I don't know how well people can see it. It's actually, the circles form a woman holding a bowl like this.
Okay. Now I can see it a little bit. Yeah, I can see the hair. And
yeah.
I thought it looked like a horseshoe here, but I could see maybe that's a necklace.
I think it's a dress with a neckline.
Ah.
Like this.
Plunging neckline. Those are always good.
Yeah.
All right.
And I think it's at one corner of the painting. She's just holding out a bowl like this.
Well, it's always interesting to me because I have no control over how you frame the shot on your end. And because you position yourself so that we could see that, I thought I better ask.
Yes, it could have been a subtle clue as to the secrets behind black chalk.
Perhaps. And
maybe it is.
Do you want to spell Paul's last name so if people are interested, they could track him down?
Yeah, Maines, M-A-N-E-S.
Is he in New York or London?
He's just moved. He's from Texas. He's just moved out of New York to Colorado.
Okay.
But he was in New York for years and years.
Very good. All right. So, folks, you learned something, a little bonus there if you're interested. Track down Paul Maness. And, folks, listen, you can find Christopher J. Yates' first novel, Black Chalk, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price right here at MrMedia.com. And if, as regular viewers know, if you're watching it on MrMedia.com, down there somewhere below Chris and I, you'll see a copy of the cover of the book. Click on it right now. You can immediately go and have it downloaded to your ebook reader, whatever that is, or you can have it sent to you the old-fashioned way via drone from Amazon. They'll have it to you in 30 minutes or less, guaranteed. No, I'm just kidding about that. But you can get it pretty quickly. Chris, do you have a website? Are you on Twitter, Facebook, any of that kind of thing?
Yeah, I have a website, which is www.christopherjyates.com. And there's links on there to Facebook and Twitter. I should probably use Twitter a bit more. I'll get around to it one day. But I certainly use Facebook, and I try and update my website as often as possible.
Very good. Well, we'll try to find you there. And, Chris, enjoyed reading the book. Very nice to meet you. Good luck with this one and with the next one. And thanks for joining us today on Mr. Media.
That was great. I really enjoyed that, Bob. Thank you.
It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Hi, this is Mark.
And this is Lowell. And if you're fans of Don and Mike, you may know who we are.
Our number one interns. You've met them on the show. They're the guys that ate all the junk, and they were outside with each other holding hands with a sign that said that they loved each other wearing the dunce caps.
And what you may not know is that we started out as fans back in their WAVA days.
Hi, Don and Mike. It's Mark and Lowell.
Oh, yeah. Hey, these are two guys that we once actually called them our proteges, didn't we?
And now we have our own show, so we want you to give it a shot.
Just check us out at the Realm Network, realmnetwork.com, or you can go to markandlowell.com.
The system is futile. It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Every Tuesday and Thursday evenings right here on the Realm Network. And catch the Poor Premium Show Friday nights. Just a Minute with Joe Ardinger.
Like most people living in California, I am deluding myself that I have the flu. But we all know it's really radiation from Fukushima. Or just the flu.
To hear the rest of this minute, to sample Joe's other minutes, and to subscribe to his newest ones, visit RealmNetwork.com. That's RELMNetwork.com. Just a Minute with Joe Ardinger, another great Realm Network production. Wednesday afternoons, right here on the Realm Network.
The preceding presentation was brought to you by the Realm Network.